So the first speaker needs no introduction.
And indeed we'll get none. I will talk about some work that's been done with or by Francis Corson for the past couple of years, who threatens to listen to this on the web and then berate me if I get anything wrong. We have benefited from discussions with Marianne Felix and her lab in Paris for a number of years, and also with Paul Francois at McGill. So the problem concerns development, and specifically the space-time aspects of development. And as such, I will relegate transcription, about which you've heard a great deal, to a black box that other people have ably dealt with. The ideas that I will pursue have a certain resonance, or will have a certain resonance, with ideas that come from the dark ages of developmental biology, that is to say, the period in the 40s and 50s of the last century, which was sort of post the Germanic heroic age and pre-molecular age. And these ideas are somewhat associated with Waddington and are rather fuzzy, hence the wooliness designation. And they were, as you may have seen, sort of geometric or mechanical analogies for how development specification proceeds. Now, this talk will follow a strict dialectical scheme as pioneered by Hegel and later by Marx, which is to say that I will explain to you why the immense successes of the molecular approach, the genetic approach to development, which has indeed thoroughly expunged and exorcised the Waddington wooliness from modern biology, that indeed the molecular approaches are so successful that as regards quantitation, they have sort of undone themselves, i.e. They're not really implementable. And as such, again, from the dialectic, I wish to then go back to these older ideas, reformulate them, and show that they can be rather useful. Now, the system that I will take is the vulva in the worm, which is a very well-studied, very classical textbook developmental system, which in the present era appears rather antediluvian, i.e. There is no big data sets. It was all done by genetics, by crosses, by partially penetrant phenotypes. And in keeping with the dialectical theme, I will try to convince you that that is very good data for the sorts of problems I have in mind. And indeed can be quantified. So the sorts of things I hope to convey to you is that one, that epistasis is very much a matter of variable choice, and it can be eliminated if you are strategic about your variables. I will explain to you or show you how many parameters it takes to describe the space-time behavior of this very simple developmental system, and show you the extent to which they are in one-to-one correspondence with experiment. And finally, I will make some numerical predictions, which are indeed predictions and not postdictions, i.e. predicting what you already know, and therefore can slightly fudge. So to amplify some of these points, let me show you this classical film of real dynamics. So that is a gastrulating xenopus egg. It was viewed initially from the vegetal future endoderm bottom part, so-called. The equatorial band, mesoderm, pulls closed like a purse string, creating the future anus. The equatorial band contracts, dives under, creates the anterior-posterior axis. And then here you're at the so-called neural stage. This is the neural plate, which will close. The head is here, etc. And as Lewis himself remarked, this is the first, and in the case of the frog, last creative act in this species' life. So besides just marveling at that dynamical picture, of course, we now know a great deal about the genes which are responsible for that patterning process. And these are some of the relevant players shown at the beginning of gastrulation and shown with their from the vegetal bottom, so to speak, view, and the convergent extension will be happening around that point. And this is just to say that on the spatial scale, these are the relevant genes. And furthermore, that we have a great deal of rather precise spatial information about where these genes are expressed. Nevertheless, when geneticists go to score mutations on genes that are relevant to gastrulation, they often resort to this brain-to-belly scheme. That is to say, from 0 to 1, you're either all belly or all brain. And as you can see, it's not so attractive to be too brainy. In any event, even a beginning genetic student can score, can realize that that does not equal a tadpole. However, although this is a very good phenotype to score, from the point of view of quantitative applications, this is not terribly useful because the genes that are involved are acting back here. And by the time you get a tadpole, all sorts of other events have intervened. So for quantitative purposes, this is not terribly useful. Thus, one impetus for what I will tell you is indeed to the desire to be able to take quantitative expression patterns like this, which can be taken at many, many time points, and quantify them to the extent that one could then say, if you take crosses between various mutants, can you predict what happens at the next time point? And this, of course, is hopeless data from that point of view. But again, although this is a very crude phenotype, there's a lot of molecular information, and all this rich molecular information is effectively thrown away because one lacks a quantitative description. So it is to provide a quantitative description that, which is what motivated the subsequent considerations. Now, you all know that signaling pathways are complex, so this is one generic example stolen from the NuSE lab. And although you know that there are certain core components to the Wnt pathway, as defined by genetics, no one has shown that there is an Ur cell which has these and only these components in its Wnt pathway. Typically, there will be these various modifying things, shown here as a, as they say, a maze of M&Ms. But it's not obvious that there's any ideal cell in which to study Wnt signaling, and if you're interested in numbers, any particular cell has varying proportions of these modifying genes, and therefore it's not obvious that you could freely switch parameters between cells, let alone freely switch parameters between a Xenopus blastula, which cells are dividing every 20 minutes, with mammalian culture cells, where they are dividing every 12 hours. Insofar as numbers go, I mean, one cannot transfer numbers between those systems, manifestly. So these pathways are indeed complex, which is the success of the molecular genetics. So let me amplify a little bit what I mean by epistasis, which will be a somewhat minimal use of the term, but adequate. So one typically has some big network. One has multiple mutations in that network. And one could ask, to what extent is the output from the network additive in terms of the two mutations, i.e., if I understand the mutations singly, can I then predict the double mutation? Or is there some other term I need to add? So this is how one parameterizes things. Of course, if one were looking at protein affinity data, protein binding to DNA, proteins bind to DNA together, underlying that phenomena, you know, there is equilibrium binding. And therefore, if I am measuring something like fractional proteins bound to DNA under this or that condition, you know that the way to parameterize that is with an Arrhenius formula, i.e., one should take the logarithm of the ostensible output before fitting parameters. Now, this is, of course, a very simple remark, but one will find figures in the papers of even my most esteemed colleagues at Rockefeller where they fail to do this in the context of protein binding things. So obviously, if we're dealing with protein binding, we know that we should take the logarithm because we know there's something equilibrium about that, and therefore this is a good guess, and therefore we know Arrhenius. However, if I then give to you the process of development where one has some space and time-dependent process, one could ask, what is the analog of this data transformation that allows you to more rationally write variables where one can assess linearity, i.e., one wants to remove the trivial nonlinearity defined by Arrhenius and get at what is more the underlying effect. And it is that subject which I will treat today. Now, my subject is, I said, the worm vulva. So that is a system which begins from a series of six cells in the ventral region of a worm, and I guess I must confess here that I personally have never seen this develop in a live worm, though I obviously should, but I have not, so this is bookish. In any event, I am told on very good authority that there is a set of 6 cells, any 3 of which are capable of making an adult vulva, and which ones actually do depends upon an external signal from the so-called anchor cell, which breaks the symmetry and gives rise to this intact vulva. And so there is the so-called competence group, concept number 1. And the as a result of that signal, these cells undergo a stereotype division pattern, and it is that division pattern which is scored in a phenotype. So how these cells divide, transverse or longitudinally, or fuse with the epidermis, is how you score the type, and you'll see data of this sort as we go along. After these cells divide, they will selectively fuse, they'll move around in 3 dimensions, and they will give you this characteristic conical structure with the anchor cell as the plug. So all this is a remarkable developmental process, and one's going to score basically the terminal cell types as defined by those division patterns. That will be the phenotype and the readout for the process, largely. Now, this subject is a textbook example of pathway integration, and I believe, though maybe Lewis will correct me, that the very early work on both cloning the Notch gene and associating its phenotype with lateral inhibition came from worm. So there are these 2 pathways, EGF in green, which signals from the anchor cell, which signals most strongly to the central cell P6, rather more weakly to the 2 lateral cells, the 2 surrounding cells, P7. As a result of that EGF inductive signal, there is then induced a Notch signal, which entails upregulating Notch ligands, repressing Notch receptor, upregulating Notch receptor, and then further mutual inhibition between the 2 pathways, which then reinforce the final pattern of this becoming fate 1, type 1, and the flanking cells becoming type 2. So there are many genes involved in the mutual pathway inhibition. There are multiple genes involved in each pathway. This is the usual complex zoo that one has. But it is a textbook example of pathway integration. Now, the nature of the data we are dealing with is shown here from a paper from Felix's lab, who has pursued this subject most intensively. And I think is responsible for, obviously, our interest in it because there is this data around. Okay, so what do we have here? First of all have, as I remind you, the division, the phenotype as defined by the division pattern for the various cells, the central cell and the 2 flanking cells. So these are scored by this, according to this key. So this is the wild type pattern in the animal. So what they then do at some defined time, some morphologically defined time in an intact squirming worm, they, with a laser, zap the anchor cell, thereby eliminating the source of EGF signal. And they then score, some hour or two later, the division pattern for the vulva precursor cells. So for example, you see here when you zap the anchor cell at this time point, you see that 8 out of 20 animals have the wild type pattern in the central cell. 2 animals have this pattern, TUTT. And the way they score that, so that's a non-wild type fate for that central cell, the way they score that pattern is to observe that at the time of first division, one of those daughter cells subsequently divides according to the P5 pattern, TU, whereas the other daughter cell subsequently divides according to the P6 pattern. So those 2 animals, as regards this cell, BPC, are scored as half 1, half 2. Okay? So in that fashion, they will say that there is a certain probability, so now we look at this table, for this particular strain of worm, of C. elegans N2, at this particular time point here, they will see a certain fraction, computed this way, of cells of P6 cells which have a 2 phenotype or a 1 phenotype. Okay, and that is the experimental data computed this way. Is that clear?
What is the precision on that?
Well, the precision is, for example, their ability to basically say that it's 2 or 1 in this case. So, for example, situations where you have an oblique division are a little bit up for grabs. But there are not very many oblique divisions here. So to the extent that at the level of the first division, you see basically either type 2 or type 1 behavior for the first daughters is how they score things with some justification. And the error bars above, so the problems are non-classifiable stuff, because we are working in the universe of 1, 2, 3. And again, their schema, which is not ridiculous when you get to molecular evidence, is that they are willing at the level of the first division, right here, to say that at the level of the first division, this branch may look like this branch, right? So in this cell here, of those two animals, this first division had one piece which looked like this, and this piece which looked like that. That's based on the division pattern. No. This is 80s. This is observing in the live worm, it's live, which is good, how the cells divide, the orientation of the division. You could observe it watching with no staining DIC. And that's what they were doing, right? It seems antediluvian, but it's very potent, as I will show you. Yes. Yes. Unknown. Unknown. However, you can do it at a variety of times. And what you will see is the mathematics that I will graft onto this thing is mathematics which doesn't care. And I would claim that's appropriate mathematics. What it does care about is that there's a range of outcomes, right? If I do it very early, I get only 3. There's no anchor signal. If I do it very late, I get all 1s no matter when I do it. And that's what matters. And the theme of this talk will be very much that the mathematics should be adapted to the type of data you have and should not attempt to fit all sorts of superfluous things which you have neither numbers nor even a complete inventory.
So just looking at the experiments, were they following these lines or were they fixing the
embryo? No fixation. You zap it and then you watch the thing divide, it's alive, and then you score the division pattern. And you will see an intact vulva if the worm survive, which I believe they do. Okay, that is the nature of the data. Okay. Now, from this Waddingtonian epoch, there emerged a number of these, again, slightly fuzzy concepts, which were things that the philosophically inclined in the 50s could argue about, obviously with intensity, because you couldn't do much about it. However, these concepts are somewhat mapped onto the mathematics, and therefore I will say a little bit about what they mean. I will show you a bit of the data, and then from that, write down a model. So you have seen the notion of an equivalence group, i.e. a set of cells that are able to assume a fate. And that's fairly well defined. You can remove cells, the remaining cells make a vulva. Competence is the ability to respond to a signal, i.e. you sort of have the molecular apparatus there, receptors, et cetera, that you can in principle respond to EGF. Specification or commitment means that your fate is defined even if you withdraw the defining ligand, i.e. if I remove EGF with an ablation, do I still get fate 1? I will then say that cell is committed. Determination means that not only will I get the prospective fate, but that I cannot knock the cell off its course by giving it some other signal. So I can't, knock it somewhere else by giving it a heat shock with notch. And finally, what you recognize most easily, i.e. the morphological changes that make a neuron, and a myocyte, those happen typically later, and of course are differentiation will be what makes a cell look like a certain cell type, which of course is happening after this other stuff. Okay, now the relevance of this is that this will somewhat get grafted onto the mathematics. Yes?
So this is what
Yes.
Where roughly
is the formula? We are deriving these things as codified by Slack, who you obviously will know very well, who is a Cambridge sort from almost that period, who is now in Minnesota, who wrote a book From Egg to Embryo. And that reflects a little bit the pre-molecular epoch, which talks about a lot of embryology. But he was sort of on the cusp.
That's classic textbook knowledge.
That's classic textbook knowledge, and it is fuzzy, I claim. People use them, and people don't argue so severely because they have the molecules, but these are fuzzy concepts, as you will see in this context.
A little bit, but not that much.
Well, okay, we will see. I mean, yeah. you can't, I mean, in a live embryo, you can't, it's not clear how to withdraw the signal. It's not clear how to put a new signal on.
Right.
I mean, what's the context, right? You can't, I mean, you graft, you do this, I mean, these are somewhat, of course, when you start grafting things, there is wound healing, and there's all sorts of other things you do when you graft, right? So it's not so clear how to do this on a live embryo.
Experimentally, yes.
Yeah, of course, well, that's, yeah, the idea, if it's not implementable, okay, that's a philosophical discussion which we will not enter. Okay, now the first thing, which is I put up only sort of parenthetically, is that it is a remarkable fact, which will play no role in the theory, but it's a fact that the theory will just assume, is that time is cell cycle. Time is not clock time, climb is cell cycle. That has been shown both by pushing around start using a rather brutal treatment of hydroxyurea, and much more neatly via the so-called heterochrotic mutants from Ambrose and company, whereby you can mutate a single gene, LIN14, which has the effect of very substantially moving the division pattern back in time as respect to these embryonic stages, yet preserving the relationship and the phenotype, and furthermore, to the extent checked, also recapitulating the phenotype of various mutants which are manifestly pathway effects. So somehow, the temporality of both pathway interactions and inductions and cell cycle all move together when you mutate one single gene, which happens to be a transcriptional repressor. That is remarkable. It is not part of a model. It will simply be assumed that time is cell cycle, because that's an experimental fact. More relevant to us, now let's blow up the time interval that we're interested in, which is this, the position, sort of this 3-hour interval between late G1, S, and the first division. So that's where the action is happening, as defined experimentally. And of course, that is an ingredient to the model, not an output. So I remarked that one can ablate the anchor cell, remove the EGF signal, and register a phenotype sort of in this time range. Obviously, less of a phenotype as you go later. It is also possible to sort of enhance the effect by taking which is a very common manipulation, you could take a EGF hypermorph, something which is a weakened form of EGF such that when the anchor cell signals, even though it's signaling, all cells go to the default 3 fate. You could then take that background, you could add EGF under a heat shock promoter, and then at various time points give it a dose of EGF. And you could ask, when does that dose of EGF restore cell type 1 as a function of time? And if you do that, you can induce cell type 1 up to somewhere a bit after the first division. So that defines very directly the time interval over which you can flip the thing from presumptive 3 to presumptive 1. Similarly, you could take a notch gain of receptor background, which has the effect of pushing. Yes?
Sorry. So you said that you can restore 1 if you do it early enough after the first division.
Yes.
So sort of within G1?
No. This is early G1, so it's just after the first division.
Okay.
As defined by, and there's data. Yeah. And of course, these are all, as Tim mentioned, these are all partially penetrant phenotypes. In other words, in 100 worms, you know, 35 can be restored at that time. All partially penetrant, and everything is all spread over the entire time interval.
So, just
yes?
First division of
this. Or the other ones, which are very almost synchronous. So the vulva cells. Similarly, one can look at a background where notch is overactive, gain of function, where you get a string of 2 cells. You could then give it a shock of EGF and ask, when can you flip 2 back to 1? And there's some time interval for that. Similarly, you could look at a temperature-sensitive notch receptor. And you could ask, when can you flip presumptive ones back to two or threes to two? So these are the types of manipulations people have done with these types of tools, and they define various time intervals when you could flip things around. That's the nature of the data. Now, what we conclude from this at the first cut is that, one, specification is gradual, but due to these ablation experiments, you sort of need the inductive signal through this time interval to get reasonably high percentage of wild-type worms. Determination is happening sometime after the first division. Again, it's a quantitative trait. There's enough binary things. If you hit it hard enough, you will flip it. And lastly, most strongly, ectopic ligands will push these cells around the fate plane, as defined by the heat shock experiments. So those are well-established but sort of qualitative facts. Yes? Right, right, right.
In the early days, it was almost as if these are two separate possibles.
Right.
And I think now,
right.
At least the way I would think
right.
of it, molecularly, because they're the same
molecule. Right.
Possible,
yes, precisely. Yes, fully agreed, and that must be respected in the mathematics.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
Right. But it should be underlined here very strongly that depending upon which worm you hit, these things are happening over rather distributed time windows. Right, this is not all worms in lockstep do that. It's very dispersed. It's an experimental fact. And the theory should respect that experimental fact. They're one quantitative traits, and they are spread out in time.
But within one,
yes.
And then within
the relationship between yes. I agree, it's all continuum, and the mathematics will reflect that, as it should. Definitely. Right, right. Yet they are extremely noisy when you do any of the manipulations. And you'll see that's throughout the entire confidence window, there is typically partial penetrance. That is the norm. Any phenotype is partially penetrant, whenever you tamper with it. Fact. Okay. So we have these antiquarian terms, and we can now graph them onto some mathematics. So the notion of an equivalence group is, of course, naturally satisfied by saying we take the direct product of our phase spaces. And furthermore, since each cell is capable of any one of the three fates, we have to write down a gene network which, cell by cell, has three fixed points, i.e. fates or fixed points. And these then get coupled together, of course. But the basic architectural design is phase space with three fixed points.
Sorry,
yes.
I understand why
yeah.
you have three fates, you want three fixed points.
Right.
I guess what equivalence group has to do with direct productness?
Oh, well, because equivalence group says here are six cells, any three of which are capable of making the vulva.
Right.
Therefore, those cells are, as far as we could find, have equivalent developmental potential, and
good.
Therefore it's direct product. I guess very neat. Yes.
So just to understand the question of partial penetrance.
Yes.
Is it just unsynchronized population? Is that what?
No. It means the populations are synchronized the best you can with the morphological markers.
Sure.
So given your best synchronization, you zap the anchor cell at a well-defined time, and then you will see that half the worms do this and half the worms do that.
But what I'm asking is, do you think it's coming from inherent sort of, I mean, you are.
No. I believe it is just variability in cells in a body. And I will show you data to that effect, quantitative data. That will come. The signaling. Which I think is trivial, yeah. I knew that a long time ago. I mean, it's nice he measures it, I think it's trivial. People have been looking at partial penetrant phenotypes for decades. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, you know, if you call it systems biology, you could publish the damnedest things. Okay. The signaling pathways, of course, push around the landscape. The notion of specification, i.e., do you assume the fate in the absence of further signal, is very neatly mapped into the notion of the basin of attraction, i.e., in the space plane, there are boundaries between things that get sucked into fixed point one and fixed point two. That's what you call a basin of attraction. And that is precisely what you mean by specification. If you land in the basin of attraction, you will go there in the absence of further signal. The notion of termination, i.e., I can't go elsewhere even if I supply other signals, is loosely the notion that these signals are ineffective near the fixed points, and that will not be very directly built into the model because we don't really look at those types of experiments too much. And similarly, differentiation, i.e., I make a neuron, I will make no attempt to parameterize a neuron. I simply will say that when I go close to the fixed point, lots of other things happen in other directions and make a neuron. I will not parameterize that. Different problem. So therefore, I'm going to write down pictures which involve literally a fate plane, x, y, with three fixed points, 1, 2, 3, which are the fates, which I will always enumerate in this order with these colors. And as you can see, just by drawing with a pencil on paper, when you draw vector fields, arrow plots on these pictures, you will see that I have three fixed points, and these fixed points can be joined together in various ways. You could ask, do the basins, which are these colored blocks which go to each fixed point, do these basins meet in various lines, the boundaries between the basins? On these lines, the flows are these convergence and extension to a saddle, so they're these saddle points. There may be a source somewhere. There's nothing mysterious about the topological classification of these vector fields. It's simply what you do by taking a piece of paper and drawing with a pencil types of flow fields, right? And this is a discrete enumeration, right? Completely straightforward. Anyone can do it. And of course, there are various types of topologies you could draw, and of course, these have to be sorted out by means of experiment. Now, I'm going to take my freedom in a topological description to place the fixed points at standard locations, which I'm allowed to do by a coordinate change. Of course, that means that I then have to fit the real signaling pathways to these coordinates, which are otherwise abstract. So I have a fitting problem to do, and it's not a priori obvious which way the pathways push me. So that has to be fit. So that's what I pay for this schematic description. And the question is, how do you fit? Okay. So now we have to parameterize those pictures. So firstly, the flow with no signals will be characterized as a polynomial, which has the feature of having three fixed points. There will be flow inward from infinity, and otherwise, and furthermore, since we're going to add ligands to this, we want the thing to saturate in some way. So that together says the simplest polynomial possible, saturation in some generic way, flow from infinity, that's it. So that is some minimal model which has these base features of having three fixed points. Now I have to ask or parameterize how I deal with external signals. So I will do that in the simplest way possible. Here is my schematic of the patterning system with the two pathways, etc. What I will do is say, I will add onto that polynomial, I will add two constant terms. They are vectors, and the vectors will reflect a direction for EGF and a direction for notch. And then there'll be a number between 0 and 1, which will be the strength of the signal. So the vectors must be fit as vectors, and then for a particular hypo or hypermorph, I have to fit the parameter L1 or L2. Okay. This is a very minimal parameterization. The signal from the anchor cell will be described by strongest in the center and exponentially decaying, for lack of anything more clever. So this is a very reduced description. Note that I am not allowing the reception of a signal to depend upon the state of the cell. That is manifestly false in various ways, but for what I'm dealing with, it does not matter. Or if you like, to put it more positively, I am building in enough structure by means of the multiple fixed points that I don't have to explicitly include that also. And you will see. Okay, right, okay, fine. It is, you know very well that depending upon the state of a cell, it may react more or less to a signal, i.e. if I'm a committed neuron, I'm not going to see EGF. And in my mathematical language, that would be saying that if I'm sitting at some point down here, for example, I shouldn't be sensitive to EGF anymore, because I'm a 1. However, in the simple parameterization, I am simply saying that I'm going to take my ligands and just add them without letting their effect depend upon where I am in that phase plane. And that seems slightly insane. However, I claim, when fitting the data of the sort I'm dealing with, it doesn't matter, because I am putting in enough of the base structure, i.e. that there are two fixed points, or let's say by stability.
So in terms of signaling pathways and ways that that might work at a molecular level, are you imagining, for instance, that you might still have receptors?
Right, 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 right. All that is, all of that molecular stuff is there manifestly. However, when I want to fit genetic data, and people have used crosses of, and I'll show you, I'll give examples. People have used crosses between various mutants to argue that there must be such interactions. So there are genetic interactions. I claim I could fit them without assuming such interactions, manifestly, okay, fact. Okay. So in that sense, by building in the fact that there are multiple fixed points, I do not also have to parameterize at this level that the reception of the ligand depends upon the state of the cell. That's obviously biochemically true, but I could fudge it a little bit or use a simpler parameterization, and I don't need it. So I could explain genetic data, which manifestly purports to show you the interaction, without having in a model of interaction, which I claim is useful content, because what it means is that I have a rather simplified description which still works for the genetics.
Having that mathematical simplification has the effect of just pushing your fixed point
yeah.
a little bit around
right.
The,
right.
the plane,
right.
and you really don't care exactly
precisely.
Where it is.
Right, precisely.
As long as it's there.
Right.
And it's not going to make a new one. Or
right, right, correct. Right. And you'll see quantitative, it doesn't matter. That's a quantitative output, it's not. Wait, that's for sure. Okay. No, no, no. It's going to be the. It's going to be the partially partitioned phenotypes treated as numbers. In other words, I'm going to use the fact that I have 32% ones. That will be fit. The point of all this thing is I'm going to fit the partially partitioned phenotypes. You will see. You will see. I mean, different alleles require a different parameter, because different alleles are different systems. So I have to fit a parameter, but that will be done. You'll see. Okay. Now, the phase space. So let's look at the phase space. So now, you will see a lot of these pictures, which is an attempt to reduce a lot of data to one visual image. So again, I'm color-coded. So this is 2, 1, 3. I will use the colors. So this is two things. I'm going to use the colors to be both. This is the phase plane. So there are no cells. This is just the abstract phase plane, which will be coupled together with the various cells. The result of our fit for zero ligands is this. This will emerge. So, but this is just a picture. So these are the basins, these are the three fixed points, and these are the flows. This is the fit. I'm just want to explain to you how the morphogens move you around, how the morphogens change the flow. If I put on hypothetical anti-morphogens, I could recover the symmetric picture you saw before. Right? So here what has happened is to go from here to here, obviously the source and the saddle have merged. So these topological singularities obviously move around as I fiddle my morphogens. So this is an abstract picture. This is what we're fitting, what we call zero ligand.
What is the initial point?
The initial point will be here, but that's fit. You will see. If I up the EGF level, I will favor 1. And as you can see, what happens from here to here is that your various fixed points come, equilibrium points come and go. If I up the EGF level further, I in fact have only one fixed point. Everything goes to 1. And the fact that this occurs for a half wild type dosage is an experimental fact that for half dosage I get wild type animals. Yes?
So here you imagine a single cell?
Right, right, right. So this is purely the phase plane with imposed signaling molecules, to which I will then build up and look at the entire row of cells. But this is merely to explain to you with these pictures, which will become more and more elaborate, how when I apply the morphogens to the base flow, I do what you expect, i.e. Notch will favor 2. And again, the genetic fact is used that half dosage is wild type.
So
Is this a result of modeling?
This is for our fit parameters is what you will see. I claim it's not a big surprise. This is a result of our fit. But because that's a result of fit, that is a fit result, to which I will then show you the data as we go on. But this is simply to explain what's in the pictures. Yes? Okay, so these are abstract directions x and y. So I simply say my cell will be described by a two-variable phase space, fiat. Roughly speaking, there's an EGF direction and a notch direction. But it's abstract direction onto which I have to parameterize the effect of the ligands by fitting to experiment. Yes?
You have to fit this point. And you say, okay, so I'm going to look at the fitness space, and now I'm going to have some experimental situations, some of them.
Yep.
Feed the parameters, and then you want to use those parameters to see if you can go farther.
Yes, indeed. Right.
That's what you're doing.
Yes, precisely. Completely straightforward.
So just to be sure.
Yes. Yes, right. Right. Please.
The picture that you have there.
This one.
Yes. Where?
Yes.
Where?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Is that the generic case, given that you have a polynomial disorder?
No. No. Let's be precise now. Generic means existing for an open set of parameters. So these are all generic cases. They also for an open set of parameters.
Well,
proper generic. Topological generic.
Just How do you want to do this, Eric? You know what I want to know, right? You have fewer stationary points.
Right.
Some of these pictures have fewer stationary
precisely.
Points than others.
Precisely.
Or at least approximately.
Yes, similar. Yes.
Is that going to turn out to be important? And in order to achieve that, do parameters have to be set?
No, not at all. No, these are all open. No. These are generic in that sense. No, naive generic.
Eric,
yes.
Just to make sense,
yes.
The picture initial condition
should be specified. Right, it will be. It's right there. It's coming. I mean, this is a flow picture. I mean, the initial condition has to be fit.
Yeah, sure.
This is a flow. I'm only telling you, just wait. It's coming. On arrive.
Can I have the last question?
Yes.
So,
It will be. I will show you orbits. I will show you everything.
Okay.
It's coming. Okay. Now, I have to now introduce the coupling between cells. So what I will do is say that there's a lateral signal. The lateral signal is manifestly a function of the state of the cell. And it will be parameterized in the simplest way possible by saying in the phase plane, there will be a line. As I go across the line, I turn on delta. I'm going to use the fact, which is experimental, that there are both diffusing and membrane-bound deltas. And the diffusing fraction will go to the neighbors. Membrane-bound, of course, is membrane-bound. And the fraction of one or the other will be fit. No. Just how much is membrane-bound, how much is diffusing. So membrane-bound talks to neighbor. Diffusing talks to itself and neighbor. That's important. Okay. How many parameters are there? So now here we get to the elephants. Okay. Superficially 14 total, one can easily get down to 10 based on plausible defaults, and one can go down further, as I'll show you in the following. So the 10 amount to one time scale for the base flow, two for EGF, i.e., the vector will by default point to fate 1, and there is the decay of signal from the axon gamma, so-called. There is one parameter for the notch vector, its magnitude. It will point to 2 by default. The lateral signal involves two parameters, which is to say basically what it takes to parameterize this line. Width is small. It will be perpendicular to the 1-2 direction. And there's a diffusing ratio, you know, diffusing versus membrane bound. There will be an initial condition in the XY plane, as you were asking, and there will be noise. And then furthermore, as I add different alleles to the soup, I have to have a parameter for each allele because an allele is nothing but some mutant, and I have no idea what the numbers are. So any new allele requires a number because I have to characterize the mutant. Okay, and I'm ignoring many things. So what we have now with the coupling is we have 5 cells, although there's on average symmetry, but individually the cells are different. So we have 5 cells, we have 10 dimensions, and we have 10 parameters. So how do you visualize 10 dimensions and 10 parameters in a fruitful way? This may seem complicated, however, it is as simple as possible, because this is the simplest developmental system you can imagine, and to the extent that other things look simpler, it means you are fooling yourself, for better or for worse. Okay, so now, here is the final picture. So now you see average orbit. So first of all, you see, we start here, that is fit. I am showing you orbits for these three types of cells. I am projecting those orbits onto the zero ligand phase plane so that I have a fixed reference for all time, but obviously the ligands are pushing me around. I am going to overlay the trajectories for three cells using colors to suggest what their wild type fates are. So the red trajectories will always be P6, the green will be P57, and then the blue will be 4-8. So these are the trajectories, average trajectories, which of course are a smear of points, and I simply show you the smear of points at the final time. There will be fit, or maybe not fit, there will be directions for these notched EGF vectors, so I show you the vectors, here they are. You see here in the dashed line, which is not too visible, there's a dashed line somewhere here. The dashed line is when the lateral signal turns on as P6 crosses that dashed line. If I look at things as a function of time, I look at the various cells, these are the, as a function of time, as these points move around, I will go, I'm initially for all cells starting in the 3 region, and then my cloud, for example for P5, leaves the 3 region, enters the 2 region, and I convert smoothly from 3s to 2s. Similarly, I am receiving a lateral signal, as indicated by the dashed line. The lateral signal, of course, comes from P6. So as P6 goes across the dashed line, it starts signaling to P57. It, of course, also signals to itself since it's autocrine signaling. So the dashed line is the notch pattern, is the notch signaling. And, of course, the notch signaling turns on at the point 1 where P6 crosses the dashed line. So thereby you see roughly the wealth of information one has when one really parameterizes this thing. Right? All this stuff is happening in time. And this is the content. So these are the various qualitative outcomes, and this is the stuff that you could follow. There's secretive signal, there's notch signaling in the cell, everything is moving and jumping and jumbling. And this is as simple as it can get. Yes? Yes.
So I'm looking at your three tracks.
Yes.
And I see these 12 lines going into the three tracks.
Yes.
Now you're putting these trajectories on that aren't honoring.
Oh, no, 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 no. Okay. That's a movie. So every particle follows the flow lines. Every particle has noise. And I simply showed you the distribution at the end with the average trajectories marked so as to make it visible. So you start here. You have... Right, the flow lines. Right, so these are not following these flow lines because these are the zero. I'm projecting on the zero. I'm projecting onto the zero ligand plane, so that the picture doesn't change. But these are following the proper flow lines. Right, but this is projecting. Right. Should be emphasized. Okay. Okay. Now, I will fit the data, which is the percentage of fates for the various cells, which is those numerical data with error bars. So. For a given cell, as you saw in that view graph, the graph of 10 slides ago, each cell is assigned a fraction of fates, 1, 2, 3. And those numbers, which add to 1, are what I'm fitting to. Okay, and I will fit various genetic backgrounds. So I will fit wild type, single copy, things called mosaics. I will most importantly fit ablation, i.e. when I wipe out the anchor cell at various times. And I will fit overexpression. And then having fit that stuff, I will look at a bunch of other situations, which I will show you as we go along. And in particular, I will sort of rather generically and systematically look at crosses, i.e., I have to fit a single mutant because I don't know what a hypomorph is numerically. But having fit the single mutant, I will then, using my non-epistatic system, I will then fit the cross and see what I get. The fitting of the base model is relatively straightforward, i.e. I minimize data minus model, and I just do some simple optimization, which works. Nothing exotic. It's a simple problem. Okay. Let me first, just to illustrate a bit the type of data we have and what it looks like, is to consider a situation of something which is being fit, but just show you that, just show you how dynamically that when I remove EGF inductive signal by either wiping out the anchor cell at a certain time or starting with a reduced efficacy EGF anchor cell, which is static in time, how I can get different outcomes if I, however, making the comparison at, as they do, at a fixed and equal induction ratio, i.e. the number of non-3 cells should be the same under the two circumstances to compare. However, the relative proportions of the cells and which cells assume what fate are rather different. So to see what happens in the ablation, what happens, so the way you see the ablation is that the P6 cells are moving as in wild type towards domain 1, towards fate 1. When I ablate, however, they stop moving in that direction. And what the fit, okay, this is data, so this I'm fitting this data. But the way the model realizes the fit, i.e. that after I ablate at some time, I get a lot of presumptive 1s going to fate 2. The way that is accomplished when I look at the actual fit is that is accomplished by autocrine signaling, i.e. 6 signals to itself, 6 makes delta, and delta signals to 6, and that then pushes me up vertically and allows me to realize the observed phenotype that P6 becomes 2. That's how the model accommodates that fact. Therefore, what is not obvious here, which was to us a surprise, is that the autocrine signaling is being fit by the ablation experiments. Because that's the only way that the model will get us effectively a notch-like signal in response to ablation of the inductive signal. Not obvious. This is the effect of merely lowering the level of EGF. You see simply, instead of the trajectory running all the way to fate 1, if you lower EGF, you get sort of a wimpy 1. But the fact of non-3s is the same. Now, let's pursue a little bit more this issue of autocrine signaling. It is possible, and this was shown in 89, that if you ablate all cells but 1, you will still see some fraction of fate 2. And that was always a big conundrum, because if you think of 2 as being as, so genetically, fate 2 requires notch, and notch at high levels will give you exclusively 2s. So notch, necessary and sufficient for 2. It was therefore surprising, given lateral signaling, lateral inhibition, to see that for a single cell, you can get substantial numbers of 2s. And this led to lots of discussions. Now, the way we fit that is, of course, as other people have said, the way one understands that is through autocrine signaling. Now, we have fit autocrine signaling from ablation. We can now predict whether we get for an isolated cell 2, fate 2. Okay? Now, to make that prediction, we have to make now another choice. We have to say that for the isolated cell, all the diffusing signal gets stuck on that cell. In other words, when you lack neighbors, the signal does not disappear into the vacuum, but sticks on the one remaining cell. That's an additional assumption. With that assumption, we could then fit data very nicely. Without that assumption, it's hopeless. So if we assume that all diffusing ligand in for a single cell will stick to that cell, we get this picture, which is then a fraction of 2s. If we do a histogram, if we do Monte Carlo in parameter space to ask how sharp is that prediction, the fraction of 2s based on sampling over all parameters consistent with our fit, we get this histogram, and experiment is 0.4. So we're not, you know, it's not great, but we're not badly off. We're in the ballpark. If we insist that the isolated VPC does not see 2/3 of the diffusing signal, we cannot fit. So we have to make this assumption. This is half a prediction. it's not ridiculous, but we have to make the assumption, which is not obvious a priori, but the model forces you to say something. And if you say something, then single cell follows from ablation. Nobody knows. This is what people argued about. Very unclear. You know, the anchor cell moves, it's a complete zoo. But we could fit under that assumption. Okay. This is more of an honest prediction. So these people have overexpressed EGF from the anchor cell. And in that situation, you could upregulate everything and end up in a situation where the flanking cells, 5-7, are half 1, half 2, and the most distal cells are a mixture of 3 and 2. So we fit to this as our measure of how we are overexpressing EGF. Okay? We then ask, what happens if we do ablation? Yes?
So when you say it's sort of green signaling, I understand, but in what sense is it really autocrine signaling? It could be many other things.
Well, it's certainly, again, within our parameter set, first of all, it's manifestly something notch-related. And it's manifest, and the source of it has to be the single cell.
Sure. But then it could be
We don't know, nor does anybody else. And therefore, we're not going to try to parameterize, you see the philosophy. I mean, we parameterize what we got, and that's it in our little world. Yes?
Yes.
No, they are correlated. Maybe we can get at that, unclear. You'll see as we go along. Fair question. So we could ask what happens if we take this thing and ablate. So we then make predictions about in the 3-1-2 triangle, sampling over parameter space, we predict, for example, we get lots of twos in a particular way, in a particular pattern with particular correlations. Right? That's measurable, not been done, but it's a clean prediction. And it's rather parameter independent, as defined by these scatter plots. Let me reinforce a bit this idea that epistasis, what appears to be strong epistasis, results from a linear model. So let me consider the situation where I take a cross between two mutants, which individually are wild type. So I will take a reduced function EGF, I will take a reduced function notch, which separately are almost entirely wild type, and you'll see that the cross has a serious phenotype. So this is half EGF, this is half notch. Cross them, and I get a substantial number of P57s, which are not their wild type fate too. This is robust to sampling over parameter space with these error bars. To illustrate what is going on here, which might seem a little mysterious, it is indeed exceedingly trivial and gives one an impression as to what one should mean by epistasis, what one should not. So here I give you a linear model. So this is a model for P57 as specified by the direct activity of EGF on them and then by the lateral signal notch from P6, which is not looked at. So we're looking at P57, and we're trying to explain epistasis there in a slightly different context, but to make it very simple. So what you have here is we define our directions, our signaling directions, as being perpendicular. So in the absence of notch, we just have the endogenous EGF signal. And in our model, that just means everything moves radially. So the orbit of P57 is this. If I wipe out the direct action of EGF and look at just the notch produced by P6, as cell number 6 moves this way, it starts generating delta, which generates notch, which gives me this curved trajectory, X and Y decoupled. When I put both things together, like the cross, in this simple problem, I can simply add vectorially these trajectories. So whereas the individual mutants never get into fate 2, the cross does. And as you could see geometrically, it's a linear problem. As you could see geometrically, you are getting what appears to be epistasis, gene interaction, merely from the fact that you are scoring fates in a plane, and there is some arbitrary boundary in the plane. There's nothing esoteric about the ingredients, yet you are manifestly getting epistasis. And in the previous problem, it had this character too, right? So epistasis is partially a matter of coordinates and what you're looking at. It is not particularly at this phenomenological level due to nonlinear this or that. The model is manifestly linear, as was the previous one. Yet you are predicting experiments which any biologist would say are epistatic.
Your point on the previous slide,
yes.
The robustness to your parameter variation.
Right, but that's the scatter we got.
So when you're running your model, your parameters, you come up with different parameters depending
right.
on the run.
Right, right, right. Right. So,
that's a sloppy parameter?
Right. I will enumerate how many things are still somewhat sloppy, et cetera, so that's coming. However, for this particular prediction, because we're going to hand this to our experiment and say, we believe this, and if it's wrong, we're in trouble, we want to put error bars on our prediction. So with the model that now stands, this is a slop, a lot of slop. But again, the theme of the story is that, well, if you produce a lot of sloppy predictions, maybe you've done something. Right? You have almost nothing to say about almost everything, as someone once characterized. Yes?
Point you're making about what the climate state is.
Yes.
What you're saying is that if I take random vectors,
yeah,
in which all the components are uncorrelated, but then insist that their linear projection on the
right.
one vector
yeah.
is larger than a threshold,
yeah.
the guy
yeah.
who survived
yeah.
is correlated.
Trivial, utterly trivial,
right.
utterly trivial, except that it's called epistasis.
Right.
But it is utterly trivial and is not particularly nonlinear, manifestly. Okay. Let's be even more brutal, and let's now consider experiments which...
somewhere there was, I mean, the act of making a threshold, which in this case
yes.
is achieved by the dynamics...
Yes,
is
yes, nonlinear. Yes, of course, right, right. But that's the ingredient, right. There is some nonlinear, right. So certainly it's a projection at the end, which is not a big deal. Now, this a little bit detailed. These, and I will maybe go quickly. Let me just sort of these are experiments which purport to show that there is pathway inhibition. So this is a particular gene, which is a phosphatase, which turns off the EGF pathway. It is activated by Notch, and therefore, okay, and the. Now, of course, there's biochemical evidence for that, which one doesn't want to argue about, but there's also genetic evidence. So the genetic experiment was to, one, okay, first of all, this phosphatase alone, so you're removing the phosphatase, therefore you're upregulating EGF. However, that mutant alone has no phenotype, because I get the wild-type pattern. However, to see something, a common stratagem is to cross it with a sensitized background. LIN-15 has overactive EGF. So now, and it has this pattern. So it upregulates the flanking cells, but there's still enough lateral inhibition that 5 and 7 are knocked down. So 5 and 7 are still off, but 6, 8, and 3 are on. So this is a sensitized background, so-called. But there is still the effect of Notch inhibition, because 5 and 7 are not 1. So then in the cross, the 5 and 7 become 1. This was then taken to say that this LIP1 has the effect of suppressing MAP kinase in the flanking cells, because manifestly you get more 1. That's the argument. Okay. However, the black numbers are fit to a model which is manifestly not interacting in the very primitive sense I showed you. We fit the data, because you should average 40 and 30. That's a symmetric situation. So we fit the data, which genetically was... So this is a very common argument. You take a sensitized background, you do something, you infer something. This is very standard genetics, which is taken to mean, as again I recapitulate, that LIP1 normally represses MAP kinase pathway, which it may well do biochemically. But the genetic data is not conclusive because we could fit it with no such interaction manifestly. And there's all sorts of uncertainties in these numbers. Okay. That's detailed, but the basic message hopefully will be taken home.
What is LIP1?
LIP1 is a phosphatase that is specific for MAPK. Biochemical. So it's probably true, but again, genetically, you can't conclude anything, although you'd like to. And they did. They published it in Science. But genetically, there's no argument, because we could fit the genetics quantitatively with no interactions. QED. Done. It's fit. There's no argument. It's fit. In other words, all these verbal arguments people use are very suspect because, one, of course, they use them when they give you the desired answer, and also the fact that you're dealing with a nonlinear system and, you know, you just can't argue verbally. Manifestly. Now, of more amusement is to look at what one might call extrinsic versus intrinsic variation, to coin a phrase. So we're back in our situation here, and we could ask, what is the correlation between the outcomes in 5 and 7 when we make various perturbations? So if we make a perturbation which reduces the efficacy of the signaling from P6, P6 signals symmetrically to 5 and 7. So if we make a partially patient phenotype which affects the efficacy of P6 doing its job, that variation should be seen symmetrically on the two flanking cells. So therefore, we have done the calculation of what is the pattern with probabilities for the flanking cells. So here are the probabilities of 3-1-3, 2-1-2, 2-1-3, etc. So I could take these probabilities down here and try to fit a model of uncorrelated induction. That model gives me probabilities of 2.88%. That's very different than what the calculation gives, which is roughly 8.55%. Right? So obviously, we're seeing much more of this than we expect. Right? So you are seeing correlated noise. What is interesting is that, in fact, there's data in this case which gives this. And this column looks rather like that column. What is being fit here is only the fractional induction, right? We have to say how strong this mutant phenotype is, but given that, all the probabilities are measured or fit. So this is manifestly correlated noise in the data and in the model, no fitting. Of course, you can go to the opposite extreme and say, let's assume there are independent sources of noise of partial penetrance in the two flanking cells, i.e., one can make a partially active notch mutant. Then, of course, you get very different numbers for these probabilities, at least theoretically. And these, of course, do correspond to an uncorrelated model, i.e., there's a probability of 3, a probability of 2, and you just put them down uncorrelated. And that indeed works from the calculation. It was not recognized experimentally that there is indeed such information in the data. So this was lying around. But given a model, you just calculate everything. Okay, there is yet other examples of this in the ablation data with similar happy outcomes. You only look at 20 animals, there ain't such good statistics. There is some technical information. We can quantify what are the remaining sloppy parameters, things we do not fit very well with data. And basically, those are in two categories. We suffer from the fact that all of these mutants we get so far are things which are hypermorphs, but there are no numbers. So we're fitting. And that leads with some sloppiness. We would be well served if someone could say that with 3 extra copies of EGF, you are not wild type, or with 0.3 copies, you are not wild type. So if somebody gives us some numbers as to what degree of over under expression starts breaking wild type, things then gel. The other thing which is still murky is that this business of the center, choice of the center and choice of the zero force play off against each other, as you would expect. I don't know how to fit that. This is all quantified. Let's just skip that. Okay. Now, people have obviously been modeling the system before for actually a goodly number of years. And let me just discuss the two most recent ODE models, which are due to these people. The first thing to be made, rather forcefully, is that these are models purely of signaling. The models per se do not have multi-stability. These are models purely of signaling, and then what? Then there's a post-processing step which says, depending upon the domain, you are fit this or that. But the domains are fit, obviously. They do the very peculiar exercise, which one can only say is some sort of bizarre social form, to select models based on volume in parameter space. God knows how this happens. That is to say, one imagines that somehow in evolution you have a complex network, and then somehow you do Monte Carlo on all the parameters, and then somehow evolution selects the right one. This may have happened when God selected Adam and Eve, but it's not clear that usual Darwinian evolution works that way. It is also not very clear why, in a particular model, one should compare parameters which differ by a factor of 10 to the fifth as regard rates, and imagine that in some sort of phenomenological model, which this one assuredly was, with only two variables per cell, that in some phenomenological model it makes any sense to have in this one the same model rates which differ by a factor of 10 to the fifth, and why that should somehow distinguish models. Mind-boggling. More tellingly, none of these models actually fit partial penetrance data, which is virtually all you got. Where they're not fitting data, they're simply saying various outcomes are possible for some parameters in this large universe of parameters. These are all deterministic models. There is no randomness. There's no point, no place to introduce partial penetrance. And secondly, although they're ODE models, they're not really saying anything about the dynamics. They're not fitting dynamical data. Amen. Okay. Yes. Okay. It's a pathology. We'll discuss it. I mean, it's a social pathology. Okay. If you see it, you should turn the page. It is social pathology. It is some bizarre norm that has been established that you do this and it somehow gets through referees because the last people did it.
Right. I want to understand though your point.
Okay. The point is that it does not correspond to any normal sense of Darwinian evolution that you take an attack network and then just look freely over some large range of parameters, those that might work. I mean, you don't Monte Carlo, evolution is not Monte Carlo sample parameter space. It sort of takes something that sort of works and makes it slightly better, moves bit by bit. It's gradient. The gradient search is not willy-nilly Monte Carlo over some huge range of parameters.
What is the volume?
Okay, volume, what they do is that by some definition or another, they compute the volume, you know, so here they have 10 parameters. And they compute the volume.
In fairness.
Yes.
I don't disagree with
yes,
you.
Yes, right.
It is a sociological point, we have to be a little more careful, right?
No, just the opposite.
If somebody came and told you, I have a model that explains everything, but all the parameters have to be fit to exactly these values, you would tell them, I don't believe you. That's a statement at one end, which kind of makes sense, right? So somewhere in your discussion of your model, you might want to know something about what range of parameters works. You might also think that that's important because there's something special about biology that can't set parameters accurately either the process of evolution or internal controls or whatever. That's fine. Those are ideas. But then those get enshrined as, let me measure the size of the volume and parameter space that's consistent with whatever I decided to fit. And obviously, the one that has a bigger volume is better. So the first statement, you know, they were sort of in error, decreasing plausible. You know, there's one statement which is obviously correct. There's another one that's plausible and interesting. But then there's this thing that gets, where they try to make it mathematical, and it gets very weird. Right. So I think that's
a good exegesis. Yes.
In selecting a model for use on a particular system, that you would prefer a model where you have a large.
Yeah, that's what they said, but has no basis in any. And of course, they're assessing volume over this huge range.
You obviously don't want the extreme opposite, but that doesn't mean that you want this.
Yeah,
it seems very arbitrary.
This volume to be zero.
Right.
Right. It can't be zero. We agree it cannot be zero.
It's not clear that having it be twice as big is twice as good.
Yeah,
that's the problem.
No, it seems very theological.
Yeah, that's also true, but that's polite, Robert.
Okay, yes. This model has a deterministic, but you put that noise. So sometimes
you could.
We're taking this or your
spending. Okay, let me go on. I mean, you'll see. Okay, fine. So we have taken a few variables, and a few variables control many, a few masses control many slaves. There's roughly speaking one variable for a signaling pathway. There is some mathematics which suggests why in very certain special limits this might be reasonable, but of course that probably doesn't apply to biology. But it's a good qualitative start because the data is not that precise anyway. The remark about putting everything into one system is both expedient, i.e. you don't have more parameters floating around, but I would claim it is also making a better model because, as Elaine was mentioning, I mean, it's all the same set of genes, right? And therefore, if you insist upon having a model which parameterizes the thing in toto, it's like saying, you know, if I'm looking at a bistable system, I really get a lot of mileage for very little money by saying, well, let me draw a smooth curve which has two minima. And just by drawing the smooth curve, I sort of interpolated, put in the qualitative facts, and I should look at that smooth curve with two.
So that was not meant to be a criticism?
No, no.
If you take this model, and I suppose you can map it onto your model just by linearizing, and then maybe
yeah.
It's possible to assign.
Yeah, you can do that. You can do that. Yeah, yeah, one could do that. One's not terribly motivated because these guys weren't fitting data anyway. Okay. We fit data. Okay. But I think it's very useful as an interpolation scheme to have one model do everything because you sort of get because obviously the dynamics in the middle depends upon the fact that you have two fixed points and you're sort of sitting in between, and the fact that you can sort of smoothly parameterize that gives you a not crazy model for very little additional effort. So you might as well do it as a model game. The cells are fixed points. That's clear in the vulva case since they are terminal fates. Of course, if you look at something else, hematopoiesis, stem cell, etc., it's not so obvious whether your intermediates are saddles or fixed points or some combination of the two. That's an experimental issue. We can think of ways of getting at it, but that's a question. Ligands obviously change topology of flow. And you could ask yourself, since we have this rather complete dynamical theory, although maybe simplified, you might ask yourself, are mutants that land near the basin boundaries take longer to specify? And we'll predict, you know, we'll produce a number. Or is the time somehow associated with the degree of penetrance? Very simple to do. No one just bothered to look at their words with a stopwatch. And also it should be admitted that the models themselves do not have any explicit parameters which parameterize the window of competence, which is put in by fiat. In other words, we're going to just define our window to be window of competence, not explicitly fitting whatever is happening to turn off the receptors at the end. And begin to create. Just put in by hand. And I guess the other lessons more generally we get from this exercise is signaling as opposed to transcription is rather more entwined with cell biology, right? You know, signaling happens because various genes in the secretory pathway. And of course, that makes it rather more appealing to parameterize this way because you don't really want to be quantitative about all of cell biology. That's a mouthful. The other remark, again, arguing for this type of approach, is that there is abundant evidence from all sorts of systems that you get the same wild-type pattern from very different mixtures of molecular pathways, i.e. the case I know, the case I have to know is mutagenesis, where Pourquier has compared mouse, fish, and chick, and the pathways involved are varying combinations of Notch, EGF, and WNTs, and those various combinations vary very, very dramatically among those three vertebrates, even though the final pattern are all somites. So there can be huge changes, and of course that's also shown by Felix and Worm. You look at various strains, various species of worm, they all have a wild-type vulva following the pattern I've shown you. You mutate them, you get very different phenotypes when you mutate. So the molecular underpinnings of these patterning processes can vary a great deal, yet the phenotype is much more stable. Therefore, it behooves one to, if you're being quantitative, to focus on the phenotype and not necessarily on all the molecular details, which are the result of a great deal of bricolage, to quote someone. Okay, the other remark is to be said very forcefully that manifestly in the experiments, their partial penetrance is the norm. And therefore, that should be a central feature of any model, not something added on at the end. It really is essential. These, you know, as you saw from those ablations, you were seeing basically a very smooth variation in fraction of ones coming or going throughout the relevant period. That's a big effect. The other way you can think about these models, if you don't like them and you much prefer genes, is that they are, in the statistical sense, what you might call null models. That is to say, this is what you would write down knowing almost nothing. And if you have a gene model with 45 parameters, you better do better than I do. And if you can't, you're wasting your time. So this is what you call a null model. It's sort of the thing that the stupid person does, and you have to beat it. It's a little bit like saying, if I just throw data at you, the first thing you do is look at a linear correlation, and you infer something. This is that degree of stupidity. It's the generic thing you do not knowing very much. I've used other some generic data, but it's what you do knowing not too much, and it's a standard against which something more sophisticated should be measured. It also, I think, rather tellingly illuminates these issues of epistasis, which are very, very prevalent in any sort of genetic discussion, and which at least was taught, what this has taught us, which I wasn't really aware of, is that how misleading those statements are and how easy it is to get things which appear for very trivial reasons, right? Once you see this obvious. For very trivial reasons, you get ostensible interaction from, you know, models which in the appropriate variables are linear. And of course, if you're thinking about parameterizing things, you definitely want to be in the variables which you could parameterize things as linear. And if you like, get the nonlinear effect from projection from fixed points of whatever, from sort of global features of the problem, and that's a very much more efficient parameterization. To ignore that, of course, means you have large numbers of redundant parameters. And if you call them genes, then that doesn't matter. Obviously, what one is getting here are lots of crude predictions about lots of things, hence it's sort of a two-bit theory, i.e., in the if you're not a native speaker of English, bit means both a unit of information, also 2 cents. These models are typically, are not terribly obvious. Obviously, the vulvar case could easily be applied to a sort of cell differentiation, defined by whatever your favorite system is. We have looked at Hox patterning in long and short-term brown insects. And there are a host of other interesting things for which, you know, these types of ideas might find application, but they're not typically too trivial. One has to think of it. Okay, and with that, I stop. Thank you. Yes?
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And,
Okay, so that is a good question, which being good dynamicists, we have thought about. So the question is, what's the experiment? Okay, and this is why ablations are interesting experiments, because if you look at these, so these are, this insert here is, are the mean trajectories for various ablation times. And what you could see is that by twiddling the ablation time, you could make the orbits go through the central point where things are sort of flying apart. And what that means, that ablation, so what you want to do is that it, find an experiment which probes a certain region of, you're basically doing an inverse problem. So having this quantitative model makes it a much more computational task of saying precisely what you need to know to do the inverse problem. But it's precisely an inverse problem. And of course, you want to do inverse problems in relatively restricted parameter spaces with relatively good global boundary conditions on them, which is what we are doing. So then your question is, you know, how do you mess with this flow so as to make it go through these interesting points? And that's, so that's why ablation's good. And what you see, for example, here is that there's a great deal of scatter in the outcomes from P6 because it has gone near that very expanding point. So if you like, you could look at the dispersion in outcomes as a measure of how much shear and how much dispersion those points were subject to. And that's all being fit. No. No, no. Everything talks to everything to an extent. Right, 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 right. Precisely, right, right. Precisely, right, 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 right. And that's why ablation is interesting, because as I showed you earlier on, we don't have absolute times.
Oh, I see. So ablation as a function of time.
Right, precisely, right. That was, right. So here's ablation as a function of time. And what you see is initially, early, there's all three. You have no induction at all. As you march forward in time, you get mixtures of 3, 1, and 2. How is she doing it? Yeah, 3, 1, and whatever. Yeah. She has different colors than we do. 1, 2, 3. So it's precisely that progression which we're fitting, and as you asked, without too much care as to precisely what the times are, right? We just say there are some times. So where's our picture with? So in one of these pictures, so I guess here, these, so we have simply taken from the experiment, naively, what the times are of the naive ablation. God knows what the EGF is doing. But this whole line may shift back and forth. We don't care. We'll still fit it. In other words, if this whole thing moves, our fit's going to move with it. We just need an array of times and an array of outcomes. And then that gives us these trajectories as they branch off the wild type and go into the center at various times. So that time parameter is very crucial. And that's why you want, so that's a very useful sort of time-dependent data. Having merely a fluorescent reporter, which we now have for a couple of these things, is not so useful. So fluorescent reporter is a very blah sort of signal. But these interventions are very good, which is why these old-fashioned experiments are very good, because they really make a gross perturbation on dynamics, and they send you to a region of phase space which you otherwise would not access, which is precisely those expansion points, which is where the signal is coming from. It's also why partially penetrant phenotypes are where the information is. Saying everything's 100% tells you nothing. You want to get the boundaries, and therefore you want to land on the boundary, and therefore you want partial penetrance. That's where the essence of it. If you ignore that, you've lost the problem. Yes? Okay. We have indeed spent a good deal of time doing a linear theory. And that's almost good enough. And get something even better. So if you do a linear theory, what's being suggested is that, well, what you care about is the decision among 1, 2, 3. And a lot of that could be happening around this central point, although it could be happening up here too. And there's mathematics to say, you know, that if you really want to be honest around the central point, you don't just say it's radially expanding, which is false and that's non-generic. That we're non-generic on. But it doesn't matter. In fact, what you should do is say these things are generically cusped. And when you do that and fit, you will pick up things that we can't fit in the other model. In particular, so here's an experiment. You have an EGF hypomorph which has 50-50, 1 and 3 in P6. You cross it with a notch receptor, which is wild type alone. The result is you get more P3. So somehow, paradoxically, weakening the notch signal gives you less 1. That is paradoxical, because notch makes 2, not 1. It's not a big effect. It's a half to a third, but it's an effect. We don't really fit that, but if you have a linear model and these arrows are as I've shown, you see that some of the, if you reduce notch, you're losing 1. So the linear model will pick that up, among other things. So it's not so bad, it's close. The nonlinear thing has more social appeal, shall we say, because the fixed points are there. But you don't, for one thing, you don't really need it. We've obviously fooled the whole raft of semi-complete models. Yes?
So, by working, make a one-dimensional model.
And that does not fit. I mean, we tried, it does not fit.
So, I mean, the spirit seems to be that you're saying, well, I want to, I mean, as you said, you started with these qualitative ideas, and you
right.
want to write down the sort of, not only do you want to write down the mathematical analog of qualitative, you want to write the simplest one.
Right.
So, what would I have to do, or what would I have to do experimentally to show that somehow it's not the simplest?
Okay. Right. Okay. No. Okay. So, here's an experiment we can't fit.
Okay.
In that model, we can't. I mean, bring down a little bit. We can't bring down. We can't because of our directions, and because of the fact that we have made the simplifying assumption that the flow here is purely radial, as opposed to this cusping, which it must be mathematically. We have trouble. We cannot fit this cross. Not a big effect. We can't fit it manifestly, and for a reason we can understand very well because. Fiddling with notch, fiddling with notch moves me between 1 and 3. That's a geometric effect which you could see the reasons for it, these things are cusp, et cetera, you have a good intuition. It's not there in the other model for the reason you understand. And of course you could throw some more parameters in. But we have chosen to not quite fit this thing. So it makes it, the fact that you have, albeit a rather crude but global model, we found to be enormously intuitive as to understand what these mutations are doing and what these crosses are doing. And just having some idea of how to put things together and seeing very explicitly how the time dependence works and, the fact that you have this zoo of, just to force yourself as a theorist to look at all these curves and realize this is what you're dealing with, right? All these signals are going up and down with time. Again, you do have 10 ODEs, and you have, whatever, 10 parameters. So you are in a 10-dimensional phase space. And that's a lot of stuff, but it's sort of manageable, and it can't get any simpler. Manifestly, if it is, you're fooling yourself. David, wait, did they have a question?
So, the story is just that we're asking those questions. Are there other places that are really not equivalent to you could have chosen a higher grade group?
Okay, fine. Right. Okay. So we are certainly, one place we are definitely cheating is at the level of the model as written. It is always possible to take a system, where the things are sitting at the fixed points, and in the model, I could hit it with a ligand, and I could knock things away from the fixed point in the model. Now, of course, I'm not going to do that because I realize this is a simplified model, and I've left out the fact that obviously it's a function of time. As I get closer to the fixed point, the cells are no longer receptive to signal, and I'm not parameterized that. Of course, I haven't parameterized that because I'm not going to fit that experiment. So the model as written is literally not true because I'm ignoring certain types of phenomena which I could fit but which are not fruitful to fit because I'm not doing those experiments. So that's a cheat, if you like. But not a severe problem for what I'm doing using it for. So I'm living within some space of fit data and I'm looking at the complete matrix of crosses. So I'm fitting a line, I'm getting a matrix. So there's a lot of output. But it's within that domain. Things that are radically different, the model is not set up to do. Right? It's not set up to, for example, fit a heterochronic mutant, LIN 14. Everything moves in time. It's not describable. Lots of things aren't described. But again, it's a useful, think of it as an interpolation scheme. Right? I have a bunch of data. I put a line through it. That's a useful way of guessing. That's your guess. It's what happens in the middle. I am doing the same thing. And you can't go far beyond my external points, my convex points. But it's useful compared to making verbal arguments.
So maybe we should
yeah.